How many times were we told as children that our ancient ancestors could not read and write until the Romans arrived? Yet if we read the actual words of Julius Caesar, we will discover that he himself informed us that the wise ones of the prehistoric tribes of ancient Europe and Britain would not have their tenets published, because they would not have those who learned by them trusting to letters. Caesar himself said they did not deem it lawful to commit those things to writing. Instead, those ancients preferred to trust the deep oral traditions of their wise ones, whose memories had been trained over 20-year periods in colleges of ancient learning. As Caesar himself recorded, the wise ones of the north believed that writing could only be employed for accounting and other such secular matters. Unfortunately, the coming of the Romans swept aside all these ancient ways, and the defeated tribes were branded barbarians by this young, victorious empire. The Roman occupiers sent in later historians to write down accounts of the traditions, lifestyles, and religions of those so recently defeated. But, like the British in Aboriginal Australia and the Spanish in South America, the Roman historians sat in harsh judgments of those whom they had recently conquered. And so the ways of the British and North Europeans whom they had tamed were dismissed as the deluded ramblings of semi-human barbarians. Just as Christopher Columbus erroneously named all of the indigenous American tribes Indians because he had been searching for India, so the Romans lazily named all the conquered North European tribes west of the Rhine Celts. This name they took from the ancient Greek Keltoi, a geographical term which, to the Greeks, had merely described the mysterious people to their far west. Similarly, the Romans adapted the name of a single tribe, the Tungurumen, to create the word German, a name they then inflicted upon every tribe east of the Rhine. Tragically, scholarship and the study of ancient British and European history has subsequently always been based on this worldview supplied by these Roman historians, whose armies and leaders conquered and suppressed our ancestors. But I believe that these remote ancestors have long been painted as barbarians with a brush unfairly handed to them by those Roman historians such as Tacitus and Diodorus Siculus, whose successful careers depended on how well they demonized their enemies. Indeed, study of the contemporary Romans reveals them to have been neither more nor less bloodthirsty in their sacrifices than the northern European tribes, just more practical and more technologically ingenious in their disposal of the dead. But there remained in antiquity great areas of Europe which the Romans could not conquer. Ireland and the highlands of Scotland never fell to the legions, and neither did Scandinavia. And it is to these countries which we must travel in order to recognize just how much of late prehistoric culture remained into Viking times. Of course, the people of beyond Rome, as it may be termed, did not exist in some romantic stasis from the Bronze Age right through to the Viking Age. But further study shows that while they communicated with Rome and sometimes traveled within its empire, the Scandinavian predecessors of the pagan Vikings seem to be the best example we can find to represent a natural progression of pagan ideas in North European culture, in this period still unfettered by Judeo-Christian ideas from the south. In making this study, I'm in no way trying to white the sepulchres of these ancestors of the Vikings, or proto-Vikings as they may be termed. They came to be believers in a violent pantheon of gods and goddesses, many of whom demanded bloody human sacrifice. But this study will serve to show that those pagan people who lived beyond Rome have been horribly misrepresented, first by pagan Romans convinced of their empire's cultural superiority, and later by the writings of pious Christianized Roman clerics and historians. This is not just because the people who lived beyond Rome were more violent and bloody than those people of Christendom, but because their violence, like the Muslim Saracens, was from a Christian point of view directed and inspired by the wrong God. In many cases, early Christians were just as violent as their pagan counterparts, but because Christianity preached forgiveness and turning the other cheek, even if they could not put this into practice, its ideals still allowed Christians to take the moral high ground. As our histories have by now all come down to us from a Christian point of view, so we tend to give the actions of the Crusaders in the Holy Land a wide berth because they were doing it all for God, that is, raping and pillaging and killing in the name of Jesus Christ. But accounts of similar actions by the Saracens or the Vikings raise our anger because their actions were all being done in the name of their alien gods. But Muhammad was not a peaceful prophet like Jesus Christ. and Islam still today believes in such a thing as holy war. Indeed, after his visions, Muhammad himself gathered up an army and made holy war on many of his neighbors. And in the northern lands beyond the jurisdiction of Rome, the Scandinavians, before the Vikings, believed also that a kind of holy war should be made in celebration of their many gods and goddesses. Indeed, later Viking belief deemed that only those warriors who died on the battlefield would join their great god Odin in the Scandinavian heaven known as Valhalla. And at the great finale of the world known as Ragnarok, even Odin would die in the great jaws of the giant wolf Fenris. The Norse myths are full of the activities of violent divinities. The thunder god Thor has an arsenal of magic weapons and drove a chariot pulled by goats. The most prominent Norse goddess was Freya, who collected the dead from the battlefield and shared it with their most important divinity, Odin. And Odin himself actively caused war and sometimes even gave victory to those who were undeserving. Indeed, these were alien gods. But the Norse myths are full of later stories overlaid and added in order to create the kind of divinities which would serve the warlike lifestyles of the Vikings. And of course, a warlike seafaring people needed a pantheon of warlike gods and goddesses. But when we look back into the distant past, to the times before the Vikings believed that access to heaven could only be gained by those who died on the field of battle, a very different story emerges, along with a very different cast of characters. For underneath the violent ragings of these warrior divinities and controllers of human lives, Odin began in the comparatively unconscious guise of Wod, a godlike weather giant to whom the ancients made devotional offerings in order to ensure a good harvest and fair weather. Yes, he raged and had to be appeased, but the acrimonious and capricious divinity that we see in the Odin of the Viking times was not yet present in Wod. He was also known as Odd, the singular shaman who, according to the Norse myths, left his wife Freya alone in order to wander into the outlands. He was also known as Ig, the unformed shaman who must hang from the tree of life in order to gain sacred knowledge, echoing the near-death experiences long recorded of shaman from North America to Greenland to Russia and so on. And Odin's tree of life was Yggdrasil, a huge ash tree which stood on a mighty mound, and which became his steed whilst he hung for 9 days and nights. It may be that the first element of the tree's name is related to the Ig of Ignite or Igneous, showing a poetic allusion to Odin's shamanic burning upon the great tree. Yggdrasil, the horse of Ig the Unformed, who took the name Odin only when he had passed through the fires of the initiation and was at last ready to understand his new role, that of initiator, that of instigator, that of harmonizer and bringer of poetic truth, Od, the speaker of the poem. The Norse myths also accommodated their version of the triple goddess in the shape of the three sisters called the Norns. These three sisters, Urd, Verdandi, and Skulda, sat at the roots of Yggdrasil and tended this great ash tree of life. And it is here at Yggdrasil that the Norse myths take on a universal symbolism which is to be found in many other ancient religions. From Zoroastrianism's central world hill to the Haram, or Great Stone of Islam, located in the Kaaba at the centre of Mecca. From the Great Saxon Pillar of Irminsul to the cone-shaped Neolithic omphalos known as Silbury. Just as Odin sought inspiration upon the Tree of Yggdrasil, so we will be inspired to discover that it was Odin, this alien war god, who was in his earliest guise at the heart of late prehistoric culture. And far from being merely a Viking tree of life, Bronze Age evidence of Yggdrasil can still be seen carved upon a hillside in northern England. A systematic study of this supposed warrior god of the Vikings will show evidence reaching far back into many of the Indo-European languages, as well as his appearance in archaic folktales and ancient landscape features. Ultimately, we will see that Odin, in his earliest guise, was capable of being a bridge between the nurturing female times and the soon-coming onslaught of the all-conquering patriarchy. Let us look now at what we know of Odin, this alien god who will surprise us all. Let us discover Odin.